session, I'm not sure we really want to talk about science at this point. That's such an interesting discussion going on, though I hope maybe by the end of this hour that we might begin to explore some connections, because I can certainly see some connections between the last discussion and perhaps where this one is going to be heading. I want to say, to start it, I don't think I'll be revealing any confidences in saying this, but someone pointed out to me last night that one of the chits of paper that we had in Vespers, where we were asked to write what we would like to see happen in order to provide a just world, well, someone wrote that they would like to get rid of the scientific method in order to get to a just world. Was that you?
It was.
Okay. And I really think in some ways the project that we've been working on together this week is really seeking ways to change our thinking about the science and technology represented by that statement, get rid of the scientific method. And I think that statement represents a certain kind of science and technology. And I think we've been looking at ways of changing our thinking, at least for those of us in the enterprise itself. Many of you already seem very enlightened, so maybe it's not you that need to change your thinking, but perhaps it's the enterprise itself. And I think one of the points I've been trying to bring across is that we really need to begin to think about science as one way of thinking. That if we can appreciate science as one way of knowing, we might get ourselves out of some of the messes that we're in. Not only do we want to think about it as one way of knowing, but we also want to remember that we can only know certain things through science. But I think we tend to forget that. And I certainly don't think we can get rid of science as a way of knowing, because I think we've been using that for probably since beginning. Let's see. So what we've looked at so far is we've talked about how we need to really situate the enterprise within the culture to think of science and technology as a social institution, reminding ourselves that it's human beings that do science, not some other kind of creature. And then as beginning to understanding this idea that science is a way of knowing, last time we talked about how a part of that is that we use abstract ideas to explain phenomenon in science. And so today what I'd like to get at is the question of where do these abstract ideas come from, and then I think that ultimately arrives at the question of examining objectivity. So what we want to focus on is where do abstract ideas come from. Again, for many of you outside of the enterprise, it's probably fairly obvious, but I think for those of us who are very familiar with the enterprise, we have no idea where our abstract ideas come from. Before I begin, I guess I'd like to suggest an interpretation of how I think these abstract ideas fit in building the knowledge so that you understand where I'm coming from. And my perspective is that we construct scientific knowledge, and that's a different interpretation than most, I would say, traditional scientists and science educators seem to offer. So I'm just offering you an interpretation. I have a new word now for my vocabulary, thanks to you all. I'll offer my interpretation of how I see this knowledge being constructed. And I should say that it's not just my idea. This happens to be a model that we're using in the science division at Capital University. So it really comes from a group of people. Beginning with Vic Showalter, who was very big in unified science in the 60s. I don't know if you know that movement, but it comes from his continued work. So let me just quickly show you the model, and then what I'd like to do is, the theory first, and then what I'd like to do is move into another activity so that we can get at this question of where are these abstract ideas coming from. In the model that we're using, what we're saying, remember, is that science asks questions about natural phenomena. So here's the world out here. One has perceptions about these phenomena, and then we have turned into language, and so we use concepts to turn into language, what we're observing out in the environment. And here we're using the notion of concept to be concrete. So we say water, for example. We all know what water is, and water is something very concrete, and we understand that. The water is clear. So again, there's clear as a concept that it's a shared understanding. So we like to think of concept as being something concrete. This is not abstraction. This is something that we all agree on, we can all see, we all have this shared understanding about what concepts are. And then according to our model, what we think of as facts then are a one-time report of an observation. So this is a slightly different definition than we use in the common world. We would say, in our common way of using fact, we say it's a fact that the sun shines. Right? But what we're saying here is we want to take fact to mean the one-time observation of something in the environment. And in order to describe that fact, you've got to use concepts. So if we were to go out down to the creek and say we wanted to examine the creek, we would say, I would look at it and say, the creek is clear. And that would be a fact, right? Then you would look at it and say, the creek is clear, and then we'd have two facts. Or I turn my head and look at it again and say, the creek is clear, and then we'd have three facts. All right, so.
But, Cheryl?
Yeah.
The first example you gave us of a concept is water, and the second is clear.
Right.
It seems to me these are quite different. That water refers to a substance, and clear refers to a quality of that substance, which might also be found in another substance, such as glass.
Right.
So I would have guessed that clear is abstract rather than concrete. Now, is this because I'm continuing to misunderstand what you mean by abstract?
No, I don't think so. Maybe it's just the terminology here. Concept can mean different things in different places.
Yes, but you said that these are concrete, that concepts are concrete.
Right. Maybe I'm thinking of naming, maybe? A concept is part of the naming process. So we're naming what clear is.
But when you suggested that these concepts are concrete, concrete is for me in opposition to abstract. And is that
But clear is something that you see, not something that's not unseen.
And you can't see it, yeah, okay.
So these are all things that we can sense.
You know, through the senses, okay. Is that one of
So things that are concrete are things that, as Kevin says, you can perceive through your senses,
right.
Whereas something is abstract if it cannot be perceived through your senses.
Right.
Okay.
And it's happening up here.
So that we perceive clearness and then we name it as clearness.
Right. Okay. And we all
But it's still an abstract noun.
Yes.
Grammatical. Okay, that's part of how
Thank you for clarifying that. For making that clear.
Right.
Oh dear. So you can see where we're headed here now that we've got concepts sorted out, we can take those concepts, build facts, and what we need then are several facts in order to get to generalizations. And so if we walked down to the creek and we all agreed that the creek was clear, the generalization would be the creek is clear. And then we go on to build more generalizations, and those turn into laws. All right? And then we can now move into the abstract world of thinking about, well, why is it that the creek is clear? Why is it that the creek looks clear to us? What's in the creek that makes it clear, and so on. All right, so we have a concrete world, and then this abstract world that helps us explain what we've got to up to here. All right, so now in this world, construct has the same idea as concept, except it's up here. So now constructs are those things that we cannot see, or we cannot sense. And I would say that there are some things about atoms that we cannot see and sense. So therefore, atoms are constructs, or energy is a construct. We cannot actually see energy. Gravity is a construct. All right. So we fit all these constructs together to describe principles, which we build into theories, and theories then, of course, that we build into paradigms. All right. So it's all a process of constructing. And where it starts is down here with us in our environment. All right. So this is an interpretation of how scientific knowledge is created, or we would like to say constructed. All right? What we want to look at today, though, is down here, because remember, we're asking questions about where do these ideas come from, where does the notion of energy come from, how is the construct developed? And so we have to begin down here. And so what I would like to do now is an activity so that we can examine this moving up from observing something in a natural phenomenon. So what I would like to do, we don't have the heavy input of scientists today, so I was going to segregate the scientists off in one corner and have the rest of us work on this and have them just be observers and watch. But would you participate with us? Okay. So what I'd like to do is I'm going to show you a natural phenomenon. What I would like you to do is ask me yes or no questions to build an explanation for how this phenomenon works. All right? So I want you to build the explanation by asking yes or no questions of me. I encourage you to work together. It works best if you work together. And certainly, it doesn't require that you be a scientist in order to ask questions. right? So let's ask some questions, because this is where our perceptions start to take shape, and then we'll see what happens. Let me just put this over here.
Can a question that we ask be irrelevant?
Can a question that you ask be irrelevant?
Yes.
Well, it depends. To me, the answer would be no.
I mean, there would be no irrelevant questions.
Yeah.
Can we ask an irrelevant question?
No, because
so your
none
question
of
was,
are
can, can,
right.
No. Can any
we
question
ask that we think is irrelevant?
Can
we be disobedient?
Can a question we think might have been a...
So you want more information than just yes or no.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, then you ask, does it matter that there is water in the cup?
I mean, irrelevant. I mean, I was just looking for a third response.
I'm only going to tell you yes or no.
Okay.
So if you want to clarify, then we say, after I ask that question, then you say, does it matter that it's water in the cup?
Yeah.
Does it matter that it's water in the cup? Okay. You want that one?
Mm-hmm.
Does it matter?
To.
Sure. Yeah. If irrelevant isn't an option.
Right.
And does the height?
I think that's important.
Does the height of the water make a difference?
Does it matter that it's water in the cup? The answer is no. Does
the height of the water?
Yeah.
Does it matter if there is fluid in the cup?
And the answer to that one is yes. And then your question was?
Does it matter if there is fluid in the cup?
Does it matter if there's fluid? And the answer to that is yes.
Does the weight of the liquid in the bowl make a difference?
Does the weight of the liquid in the bowl make a difference? I think the answer to that one is no.
Well, but are you asking about how much water is in there or how heavy?
Just how heavy the weight of that liquid,
well,
which is in the bowl.
Yeah, I guess it would be yes.
I think
water.
It makes a difference.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Right. But if it, say, if it were water instead of jelly, you'd need more.
You have to ask me a yes or no question.
Yeah, I'm not asking you.
I'm
trying to understand.
Okay.
Is there a transfer of matter between the cup and the bird?
Is there a transfer of matter between the cup and the bird? Okay.
Exchange
yes.
Matter.
Is there a transfer of matter?
Why did you say matter instead of fluid?
Energy. I'm thinking.
Matter would be
I'm
more
thinking also, is there a transfer of energy? But I
but
want
you
to go
ask
with
that.
Matter first. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay. I'm not sure. I go for generalize and then go for...
Is there a transfer of energy between the cup and the bird?
Is there a transfer of energy between the cup and the bird?
That's assuming in either direction.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. The answer would be yes. Is there a transfer of energy?
Does fluid go into the bulb of the bird as the bird tips over?
Does fluid go into the bulb of the bird? No.
Are there gravitational? Oh, of course it could not be gravitational force.
Could you maybe say more about your question to make sure I'm understanding you?
I'm wondering whether water goes into the bird's beak down.
Okay. So does fluid go from the cup to the bird?
Right.
Bulb? Okay. Does fluid go into the bulb of the bird from the cup? And that would be a no.
Will this go on forever?
Will this go on forever? No?
No. Does the bird's beak have to touch the fluid every time it goes down?
Okay. Does the bird's beak have to touch the fluid?
Do we have to guess the answer in 20 questions or less?
We're just building an explanation, so
does we can, to make really it
stop,
keep going.
We can really stop anywhere.
Is implied, right?
Now, is the I don't know how to form this question. Is what's happening a have something to do with the temperature?
Okay. Just the lip
question. Does it have something to do with temperature?
Will it stop doing it if the water evaporates?
Okay. Does it have something to do with temperature? And the answer is yes. And so your question is,
will the bird stop bobbing if the water evaporates? If there isn't water.
I mean, if there isn't water for the beak to touch?
Well, I don't know that it's even touching it.
Well, I already asked that in the
news. Yes, it is.
Okay.
Is
Does this have something to do with humidity?
Okay.
This whole process of the...
Yes. It must, yes. You have a question?
Yeah, is the water in the cup red?
Is the water in the cup red?
I don't know if you start by that question, I like that one. Is the water in the cup red? The answer is no.
You're doing good.
Is the
getting lots of information.
Is the bird attracted to the temperature of the water?
Is the bird attracted to the temperature of the water? No.
Is there a vacuum inside the...
Is there a vacuum inside?
The bird?
That tube, or the whole product, you know, the... It's sealed off.
Does gravity cause the swing?
I think the answer to yours is no. Question is, does gravity cause the swing?
Is the bird polarized?
Okay, hang on.
Does gravity cause the swing?
Part of it?
We got into an answer. It's not either yes or no.
Let's see, there's another question.
I asked if the bird was polarized, if a positive or negative charge.
Uh-huh. Is the bird charged? Nope.
And the rest of the business.
If there is less humidity than more humidity in the air, now if this air here were more humid, would not that bird be bobbing less frequently?
Okay, let me see.
So in other words, with air humidity,
it's got to do with the evaporation of water from
the
bird's
beak. Determine the rate of the
bobbing. I know that. It's got
more humidity.
Something to do with it's like.
So if the relationship between humidity over the cup and the room are the same, if they're in equilibrium, then
it wouldn't bob.
Then it wouldn't bob, even though it's humid.
With more humidity, would the bird bob less? No, the answer to that would be no.
Okay, then that's not.
Can you replace the cup of water with some other object and still have this work?
Solid, liquid, or gas object?
Solid object.
Okay.
What, like an ice cube?
Like a wooden box, a wooden block. The same size?
No. Is the bobbing not related to the isn't the bobbing related to the evaporation of water from that bird's beak after it has drunk?
Isn't the bobbing?
Supposedly drunk.
How much of it just is?
Yeah.
Okay.
Is the bobbing?
Know what the answer means.
Okay.
Related to
the evaporation of water from the surface of the.
Okay. Is the bobbing related to evaporation of water from the surface of the bird's beak?
Yes.
Is the bird's head empty?
Is the bird's head empty?
It's a bird's head empty.
It's a stupid bird. Is the bird's head empty?
Yes.
No wonder
it just is. If you took the head off, would it still work?
If you took the head off, would it still work?
Head?
Hat.
Can we try it?
With no hat, no, we can't try it. With no hat, will it work? I'm going to say yes.
Does the bird's beak have to touch the surface of the water?
It
said it touched the bird's beak, have to touch the fluid.
Uh-huh.
But the fluid in a gap, it's fluid is a liquid, I guess. Gap?
Does the
Because the evaporation is a gas.
Have to touch.
Maybe it is already out.
No.
Because
that's
up
a
above
yes,
it,
no.
Had, it had to touch, it had to touch the fluid. So that's different than I can take it than the surface. Right.
So you're asking if it just has to. See,
does
it have something like necessary or sufficient?
Does it have to break the surface?
Does it have
to
break
fluid?
The surface?
Right, to touch.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a different question. Does the beak have to break the surface? And then that would be yes.
Is a wet beak heavier than a dry beak?
Is a wet beak heavier than a dry beak? Yes.
Is a wet beak cooler than a dry beak?
If the barometric pressure was less, would the bird move more slowly?
If the pressure is less, you're really making this hard on me. If the pressure is less,
it would be easy.
That's why I was going to ask the scientist not to.
Currently 911 millibars.
If the pressure is less, will it bob? What direction?
Bob more slowly. Bob slower.
The pressure is less. Let's see now. The pressure is more. The pressure is less. Will it bob more slowly? Yes.
Is there a partial vacuum inside? That water, I know it's got to be because that water goes up in there because that water just can't ask the question right.
As the bird bobs, it is air pressure building.
As the bird bobs, is air pressure building?
Inside the bird.
Yeah. Pressure building inside.
So does the air pressure inside the bird change?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, that doesn't know if it goes up or down.
Yeah.
But,
yeah. Yes.
Does the red fluid enter its head?
No. Would the temperature of this fluid, to freeze this fluid, would it be a higher or a lower freezing temperature than water?
That's a good question.
That's not a yes or no question.
Yeah, turn it into a yes or no question.
Is it a lower, does this liquid in the bird have a lower freezing temperature than water?
Lower freezing temperature.
Temperature at which the liquid goes into the solid. Let me think here.
Yes.
Okay, we're going to stop.
Because remember, the purpose of this was not really to figure this out. The purpose
was
to
tell us, though, right?
Examine the process.
I don't know. She almost let us open the boxes yesterday, so I don't know if she'll tell us or not. She's...
There were some who claimed that she didn't give permission to open the box.
I didn't. Yeah, yeah. She said.
But I interpreted it differently.
No, that was my interpretation, too.
Can we talk now about what happened? Let's try to replay it in our head, step back, and watch what happened. And I'd like to keep track of that as we talk about that. I'll do that over here. And I think we need these questions up. So, what did you notice about the process here, or what did you notice was going on in you?
Well, one thing I noticed is that we refined each other's questions.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, in collaboration, refining of questions. Mm-hmm. Took place. Good. What else happened? You've been observer. What happened?
Well, I was frustrated that we couldn't ask anything except yes or no questions.
Okay. So you were frustrated by the limitations?
Mm-hmm. In this language.
Okay. Can you say more about what you mean about this language?
The more questions were asked, the more similar concepts came to mind.
Okay.
Concepts is the right word there.
Okay. Your questions over there. Did you notice anything? Like she asked this question, does the bird's beak have to touch the fluid? Right? That came from her, but it didn't come from back there. So
she could say that it was touching.
Okay, so what does that tell us about questioning?
Makes a difference where you are.
Okay. All right, so your perspective?
And also, I think prior knowledge is important, because Rick asked a question about barometric pressure. Like, hey, you get an answer, and I'm like, oh, I don't know, that didn't help me one bit. You know, so?
Could you say more what you mean about prior knowledge in this
case?
Well,
first of all, that he knew to ask, he knew about some, he could ask about something he knew about.
Okay.
He knew that there was this thing, barometric pressure. So it shaped what question he asked. And then, even though he was able to ask the question, because he had that prior knowledge, the answer to the question gave him more knowledge.
Okay.
But because I only have a vague notion of what barometric pressure is, the answer didn't help me.
Okay.
So I didn't think of the question, and once the answer was given, it didn't advance my knowledge.
Okay. All right.
And if I had a different kind of
knowledge of barometric pressure, I might not have thought of asking the question, but the answer might have helped me.
Okay. So you get more understanding from the answer if you have more prior knowledge?
Right. So it does two things. It shapes the question you ask, and it shapes whether or not answers
are make any difference.
Can you move on?
You can move on. What else did you notice? Maybe we should take a minute to look at the questions here. Do you notice anything about the questions? I mean, you said that Mark had prior knowledge, but I see all kinds of prior knowledge.
Yeah.
I mean, well, yeah. I see the word vacuum, gravity, humidity.
Right. Yeah, that was just a more dramatic example.
Okay.
And I also noticed that, for example, we didn't ask any questions about how it smelled.
Okay.
That we tended to use our sight as a primary sense.
Okay.
But we also didn't ask any questions about the shape.
Yep.
Smell strikes me as very strange.
Uh-huh. This group used sight as the primary sense, but even then, that's interesting, isn't it? And what does that tell us? That tells us something about questioning.
I'm sure it does, but it's not clear from what.
Seems like we're thinking maybe of it more in the abstract already.
Okay.
Than in the concrete bird with the hat on, except we did ask the question about having the hat on.
Yeah, yeah, you were using energy and evaporation and those kinds of ideas. So it looks like your questions were shaped by some abstract thinking?
Well, no one got out of their chairs and went over there and observed it from very close. It was like sort of sitting and observing. Mm-hmm.
And why do you think that? Why do you think that is? That no one got out of their chair.
We're all too intimidated.
Okay, there was maybe some kind of socialization here that said you got to play by these rules. Mm-hmm. Okay,
you're the instructor.
Okay, so
you're the instructing
more. Well, and because we were using our sight, we assumed that what we could see from here was what we could see. And if we wanted to use touch, then we would have gone up there. If we wanted to smell or hear, we would have had to go closer. But I think we assume, in large degree, that we could see from here what we could see. But some of those things, like is there water in the cup? Is the fluid in the cup red? We could have found those out for ourselves. But you said, ask me questions. So we asked you questions.
Okay. So how can we? I think that's an important. I think both of these comments are important. So how can we? I want to say something about maybe socialization or something.
That has something to do with the. I don't know if this is what you're getting at, but I'm thinking back to being in the classrooms where I came the closest to being a scientist in biology and so forth. You're really inhibited by. The scientific method, maybe, or in, I don't know how.
Well, I don't think it's, I think it's the practice, maybe, not necessarily thinking.
Yeah. It seems that there's a common sense here. There weren't any metaphysical questions.
Okay.
We didn't ask if there were demons trotting up to the head of the cup and sliding back.
Well, we learned last time that science is about natural phenomena.
But I think you're saying maybe something about prior knowledge or
an
experience.
So that there's a common sense or a sense of commonality which we share.
Common understanding.
We assumed it wasn't a trick.
Okay. So you had some faith, huh?
Oh, it's me. I bought one. It was in the past, and it didn't, and the damn thing didn't work. And I when you first set it up, I was finding myself thinking, boy, I hope this thing works.
I did try it before we started. I've learned now that you just can't. Oh, I want to get back to Elizabeth's comment here about shape. I'm wondering if maybe there's something there. So why didn't we think about questions about shape? Do you think it could have something to do with how our culture sees? That maybe something about our training, something like that?
Well, I think it also has something to do with the kinds of questions that were being asked. I mean, we started on one track,
okay.
And we just kept going on that track. And I think if someone would have, you know, out of the, you know, just kind of been off, out of, you know, doing their own thing and ask about Shay, that maybe people would have come along. But once we started on this train, then everybody just attached themselves along.
I also wonder if the Shay being camouflaged as a bird makes us, you know, it's a bird. Uh-huh. You think, oh, this is a toy, and it's a bird, so it'll be cute. So we make some assumptions about the shape being irrelevant because it's dressed up like a bird. Uh-huh. And the one thing about shape that might have been interpreted as a question about shape was the one about the hat.
Uh-huh. Okay, so let's see if we can make that into a broader kind of statement. You make assumptions about what you're seeing.
Right, we assumed that shape was irrelevant, perhaps, because it looked like a bird.
So therefore, your questions weren't. So your assumptions shaped your questions.
Right.
Okay.
Maybe a maxim: silly can't be serious.
Okay. All right. That's good. That would be an assumption, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Definitely. Let me see if I can pick out another kind of question here.
Well, as you said before, we have some questions that are based on what we can see and some questions that are based on abstractions that are part of our prior knowledge. So you could break down the questions into things that you could ask simply on the basis of observation.
Okay.
And if we had stayed more on those, we might have asked about shape.
I think with the rules that we're presented with, I think we were led off in different directions with the time constraint of thinking about only an hour, and this is only a little part of it. So when somebody asks a question, I'm not even sure what they does the beak have to break the surface? That was one of mine.
Yeah.
Yes, but does it matter? Uh-huh. Well, that one was a doesn't matter one. But there were a lot of questions asked. That's not a good example. A lot of questions asked out there where you would say yes or no, but they might be irrelevant.
Uh-huh. So I think.
But we didn't have that time. I mean, we ask the question and get a yes, and then if somebody would automatically say, but is that relevant
mm-hmm.
to what's happening here? Mm-hmm. When we couldn't do that, I think we were let off.
Okay. Well, we could have.
We could have let ourselves off.
Because that would have been a yes or no.
We could have asked the question.
Then although we refined each other's questions, we didn't pursue one path of questioning. We have random questions.
Yeah. Okay. So let's see. Well, I really hear two things. I hear what you're saying is there's some limitation. The answers give you some kind of limitation to where you're going to go.
Yeah,
the answers. You found the answers.
Kind of. I found that, but more so, I found the format we were in without having an irrelevant.
Okay. So the yes or no we found limited.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And that was said right at the beginning by somebody else, really.
Yeah.
But that particular point.
He talked about how he felt about it, which he felt frustrated, and you're just describing that.
Yeah.
And then what was the point that you
made? That we asked more or less random questions rather than pursuing one path of inquiry.
Didn't necessarily follow.
That, you know, we might have asked a whole bunch of questions about temperature until we found out why temperature was relevant, and then moved on to ask about weight and on to ask. But we just kind of went.
Mm-hmm. You know, the whole thing assumes the cause and effect of a certain kind is operating.
Mm-hmm.
And it occurs to me, maybe the cup and the bird had nothing to do with each other. And we just assumed they did.
Okay. All right. And certainly that notion of cause and effect is important to the enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
This is Zen Buddhist would have asked very different questions.
Exactly. I'm going to put that down here. Zen Buddhist. Anything else?
Someone asked if it was a block of wood, if it would work, and you said no. But yeah. So there was something in the relationship between the two that would lead us to think cause and effect. I guess I do, based on substituting those two things and not having it work anymore.
Yeah.
I agree, Mike. The whole thing assumes cause and effect.
Right.
But maybe that's not the most interesting thing about what's going on at all.
So what are we saying in a kind of general way? Maybe we're talking about the way of knowing, which is assumes the cause and effect, and what could we learn about natural phenomenon?
Well, do we assume then that that when we're dealing with natural phenomenon, that there is a cause and effect, and since we were dealing with some kind of natural phenomena there, that our questions would be cause and effect questions?
Sure.
Because that's what happens in natural.
Sure. And where does the idea of cause and effect come from? Does it just come from the fact that it's a natural phenomenon, so we think it's cause and effect?
No. It comes from the Western notion of the human will.
Or science.
I'd say that science comes from the prior assumption that we will, and that makes things different.
Okay. Beautiful. That's one of the points that I wanted to really stress with this. You can see that there are all kinds now of issues that we could go back and talk about in terms of what this means about science. You know, this activity really brings out a lot of different things to think about. But the one that I want to focus on is, I think this says it's nice, we've got a nice big broad picture of what I want to say, and that is that one's perspective shapes one's question. And so because we live in the West and we have this notion, it shapes our knowledge, it shapes our abstract idea. And we don't acknowledge that. At least when you're inside the profession, you don't acknowledge that at all. Right. So, for example, I'll just give you one example out of my field. There are all kinds of examples.
See how quickly authority erases our work?
Yeah. It really is a beautiful piece of work, isn't it?
It was.
Still is.
I want to give you one example from my, and I'll use my phone in here. Okay, here's a chemical reaction. I don't think you recognize it as a chemical reaction because of your prior knowledge. And let me just say, in my field, the way it's described that this reaction takes place is the following. This reaction is interpreted to take place in the following way. This reaction is interpreted to say that this species has a backside attack on this carbon, and this species leaves. This is called backside attack.
That's how you actually talk about it, is what you're saying.
Let's talk about it.
How long has it been talked about like that? I wasn't
at that. This comes out of a standard organic chemistry textbook. It talks about backside attack.
It's been going on for hundreds of years, or
well, I don't know, that would be a very interesting question, I think. Perhaps not when... It would be a very interesting question to know the historical usage of this terminology. But that's how it's talked about today. And I can say from a personal point of view, it didn't occur to me what this meant until a young man, kind of pearly man, student came up to me and said, let's talk about the backside attack reaction. And I was like... I mean, you know, so I never noticed the cultural.
And the second era was referred to, how did you say?
This is a backside attack. This is a leaving group.
Leaving group.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's just
That's just one example of how we take from the culture and put it into our theory. Okay. And I'm sure there are others. Anybody think of any others that they know out here?
How do you think a feminist in your profession would change that phrase?
Well, I no longer use the word attack at all. When I talk about molecules attacking, I say molecules come together. So I don't even use the language of attack. I like not to use the language of collision, because that's another way to describe reactions, is molecules colliding, and they have to collide with the right amount of energy. Well, to me, that's very violent. So I try not to use that language.
But Cheryl, when you do that, when you change the language, do you translate for your students? Do you say, now in the textbook, you will read this, so in order to advance in this field, you need to know this language that I'm not using?
Because I recognize that I have an interpretation, I make it very clear that what I have is an interpretation.
We do the same thing in theology, and it's sort of why we have to give that language some credence just in order to
right.
attack it.
Right.
Or to be part of the conversation, even. Not even to try to undermine it, but just to be part of the conversation, you have to be able to speak the language of the dominant language.
Yeah.
And what I'm not trying to suggest that we throw out the idea,
just to call it something.
Because some people might think that what I'm trying to suggest is that this knowledge is worthless. What I want to suggest is, if we think about what we're doing with it, we can learn it and then move forward.
And what you're saying is that an abstract idea isn't really abstract.
It's not anything pure.
Right, but I just looked up in the dictionary this morning the word abstract because I'm really fixated on this. And it says that one meaning of abstract is pure.
Uh-huh.
Or that a meaning of abstract is something that is general without regard to specific case, which may be the one that's most helpful for me to understand what you mean when you talk about abstract. But it is interesting that there is that one meaning that is something that's pure, and yet what we discover here is that once the concept is put into language, the language impurifies. Do we have purify, but not impurify? The word impurifies the concept.
Well, I don't think you can
ever
have a concept that's pure, right?
No, but the concept isn't pure, but the language may do something to the concept that isn't even part of it, which is what you're suggesting by saying, instead of using the word attack, if you use come together, you're looking for a more neutral way of articulating this abstract term, this abstraction.
Or if not more neutral, differently biased.
Right.
Right. So then,
but see, she says, comes together, not attraction. Coming together is, well, I guess that it still is biased, but it's a gentler form, to use it gently, and I think that's masculine, feminine. But it posits, to come together posits less, or implies less causation than collision or attraction. Either of those would suggest something about why they come together. Come together describes what you observe.
What if they both had a free choice and they just decided to do it?
Right.
Well,
here we have another interpretation.
Well, would that then come together be a less strong of a statement? Would it mean less? I shouldn't want to use that word, strong. Would it mean? Would it not would it not impart as much information?
Would it not
possibly?
I think it imparts something different.
Or different information?
I think it imparts something different. And that I would say that if we think about it as this way, we're limiting limiting our understanding of what may be happening. That the whole area of chemistry is kind of stalled at the moment, I would say, and that we've got this whole other area in physics called chaos theory, which is going to move in and it's going to pretty soon affect chemistry, which means we're going to have to think differently about what's going on. It's going to have an implication.
It's more random.
It's
a lot more randomness involved.
Then we end up with some order, though, out of the randomness.
So it's actually what made this move is the butterflies over there by that building.
Can we just take a minute? Oh, no, we can't. We're done. Maybe what you want to do is take a minute to think now about your science experiences and how this understanding brings something from your experience that perhaps you didn't think about before. But I would like to argue that this makes chemistry, to me, very unfriendly. And even if you were sitting in a chemistry classroom and not thinking about it consciously, I think in some unconscious, subconscious way, it would make chemistry seem very unfriendly. And what we're saying also has implications for the practice of the teaching as well, and the experiences of the learners. So, yeah.
Just on the gentler, kinder kind sure. of chemistry lab, I could translate it into a gentler, kinder hospital room, uh-huh. things like that. And how do we view cancer, for example? Uh-huh. We talk about killing cancer cells.
Eradicating.
So the scientific language, the technical language, then becomes imposed on the body.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The body then is interpreted in a particular way, so right. we become aliens to ourselves.
Right.
So that the scientific language then has a very practical effect on how we view ourselves, how we treat, how we understand sickness.
Right, right.
The other place that the great language of violence gets used so much is with regard to computers. And although some people have shifted that, you know, you used to have, like, kill the file, and then someone would complain and you change the command to erase. But the language used around computers is very much, you know, why do we call it a menu?
Why do we call it saving a file in my system?
Right. Well, and why are saving and erasing the opposites? Or don't they?
And so really, I think ultimately, we haven't really made this conscious, but we are getting back to the previous discussion, because all of this comes out of our experience. And really, I really think it comes out of relations between men and women. Wow, this has been terrific. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Cheryl.
Now, you going to tell us?
Yeah.
She won't sit down now.
Can we go up and put our fingers in the water?
Sure, you can examine it if you like.
You're about to examine the water. I could ask them about temperature. Well, right, and then you've got more than yes or no. You can find out what the temperature is.